Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. And we are going to be talking about A Meaningful Life. Born to be Good is the name of this book, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Humans do things like blush and laugh and tease. And we'll be talking about the fact that we have evolved positive emotions like gratitude, amusement, awe, and compassion that do promote ethical action and are the fabric of cooperative societies. How does knowing the evolution of the blush, the touch, the kiss, or goosebumps — that's a weird one, isn't it, to get goosebumps — help us find happiness and goodness? The answer lies in insight, in gen science, according to our guest. And our guest is the author of Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Professor Dasher Keltner is our guest. Professor Keltner is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, director of the Greater Good Science Center, and editor of the magazine Greater Good. His research has focused on the biological and evolutionary origins of human goodness, with a special concentration on compassion, awe, love, and beauty, as well as the study of power, status, and social class, and the nature of moral intuitions. He's participated on two scientific panels with the Dalai Lama, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. I think we'll have many. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you can do that, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Kathleen.
I feel like we ought to start with a good laugh, because I know laughter is important, and it's 9 below 0 in Milwaukee.
Oh, no.
I know. Sweet.
I remember those days. I was a professor at Madison for 4 years. So
yeah, I saw that.
A warm day is inside your freezer. So
yeah. Right. So tell me, how is it that studying the evolution of all these things, particularly blush, touch, kiss, goosebumps, can help us find happiness and goodness?
Well, I think in a couple of ways. The thesis of the book is that humans have evolved as a very cooperative, caretaking species. And we've evolved these amazing emotions and these social behaviors like touch and goosebumps and laughter and soothing, caretaking emotions like compassion. And I think in studying these emotions, and I felt this in my own life, it helps us be happy and lead ethical lives in a couple of ways. One is it gives you a lens onto the more benevolent side to human nature, and suddenly you see how cooperative we are, and you see how laughter brings about peace in conflicts between siblings. A second way, I think, is that it gives us really important insight into our own human nature, and the idea that there are all of these important emotions like gratitude and reverence and compassion, that when we reflect upon them and we cultivate them, say in a meditative practice or by going to a museum and studying art, it brings out our brighter side, if you will. Mm.
And yet, we just spent the last half hour talking about what's going on in Gaza, which I feel like I've talked about for years and years and years and years. So what is to lead us to believe that, in fact, we don't live very hard lives that are short and we die, and sometimes we die too young because of war, and we go to war.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, and that's always one of the first questions you should ask about this general thesis that we have this, that we're born to be good. And the question is, well, how do you account for the genocide in Rwanda and what's happening yet again in the conflict between Israelis and the Palestinians? And my answer always is really an answer that Walt Whitman would offer, which is we are many things. Mm. We're very complex. And regrettably, our science has really prioritized the dark side to human nature. And that's really important to understand. But we also need to know, just from a scientific perspective, all of our cooperative tendencies and how they help us.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what you mean by gen, J-E-N, which I understand is pronounced differently in Chinese science.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, what a great question, Kathleen. For the past 15 years, I've been doing this Darwinian science, looking in frame-by-frame analysis at emotion, at laughter, and what happens when we blush, and how everybody around us forgives us, and really brief touches that soothe people's stress-related physiology. And I was looking for a concept or an idea that united all of these amazing emotions that bring out the good in others and that make people closer and form tighter communities. And ironically, I couldn't really find it in the English language. So fortunately, my dad has always gotten me interested in Eastern philosophy since I was a young kid. And as I was reading Confucius, the central concept in Confucianism, 2,500 years old, is Zen. And it's about respect and humanity and kindness and reverence for others. And, you know, there's so many beautiful quotes in Confucius about this idea of Zen. One is, a person of Zen does not bring the bad in others to completion, and instead brings the good in others to completion. And that idea really captured the core direction of these emotions I was studying.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that a nice thing to contemplate, to bring out the good in others?
It is. And you know, then it led me to think about, you know, we're interested in science about, you know, can we find these quick ways to evaluate our lives, you know, measures, if you will. And I just thought, boy, any time that I find that I'm acting in accordance with Jen, right, by being compassionate or telling a joke that diffuses a conflict or touching somebody who's in duress, mm-hmm. I find I'm happier. And I think there's an amazing new science of happiness that is finding that, in a way, our quickest route to happiness is to make others happy.
Hmm. And you talk about this Jen ratio in the book, which is, what is it, the number of times that you bring out the good?
Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, that was a funny arrival. You know, so as I did this research, and I would you know, look at families or in the park, or I'd look at my daughter's playground, or I'd think about my marriage, or I'd think about the state of affairs between the Palestinians and the Israelis, or the state of our culture, and I thought, well, you know, what's a way to take stock of how we're doing? You know, you can ask, are you happy? But I think there's really more to it. And so I came up with this idea of the Jen ratio, and it's very simple, which is, it's a simple ratio, and in the bottom of the ratio, the denominator, you put, just in the moment, all the actions where people are really bringing out the worst in each other. You know, what's happening in the Gaza Strip, for example. In the numerator up on top, you put in that ratio, all the ways in which we're acting in accordance with Jen, where you're bringing out the good in others. And that's a good way to think about the state of a person or a marriage or a neighborhood or a community. And so I was led to that.
Mm-hmm. You also did a great deal of studying, and this guy's a real fascinating guy who's influenced you. You sought out Paul Ekman, who was the first to study emotional expression and look at the thousands of movements of the face. Tell us about him, how you latched onto him, and what he, in his travels in the world, and what he learned about
expression.
Well,
you know, without Paul Ekman, I wouldn't be here. And without Paul Ekman, Richie Davidson at Madison, who has a book coming out, and all his amazing neuroscience, probably wouldn't be the scientist that he is. Paul is really, truly a remarkable human being. And what he did scientifically was he got interested in emotion through reading Darwin. And the first thing that he did is he did some of the first studies where he traveled to New Guinea in the mid-1960s, when no one believed in evolution and no one really thought there was universality to human nature. And Paul almost lost his life. He traveled to New Guinea, lived there for 6 months, and did this famous study where he found that the Fore of New Guinea, this people living in a pre-industrial circumstance, expressed emotion just like you or I would, and they judged emotion in the face just like you or I would. Mm-hmm. And it was a landmark study. The second thing that he did, which really, you know, in a way changed my science and my marriage and how I get along with my kids, is he spent 7 years figuring out, without funding and without an opportunity to publish this as a scientist, he figured out how to translate the ways in which the muscles under the surface of your skin influence the appearance of your face, so that you could code every muscle movement and combinations of muscle movements. And what that gave to me, to Richie Davidson, to other people interested in emotion, an ignored part of our science, is a way to study emotion in the moment and to look at the face and say, that person's embarrassed, or that person is ashamed or angry, or that person is flirting with my wife. And that was a remarkable gift.
And is this something that we intuitively know?
Yeah, I think so. I think what we all feel and what neuroscience is showing is a big part of your brain is devoted to perceiving faces and detecting emotion. It's you know, understanding other people's emotions, in particular through the face, think about it, is how kids and young infants and parents navigate the environment. It's how people flirt with each other, negotiate hierarchies. So this is a deep part of our brain, and we feel it. We have these gut feelings when we see other people really quickly, whether they're happy or not or trustworthy or not. And what Paul gave us is a language that we could be very precise in how we describe those feelings.
And is there something I've noticed? Sometimes you look at somebody or you look at families and you notice this similarity, and it takes you a while to figure out what it is between a father and a daughter or whatever, and you realize that it's the facial expression, that they're doing something, you know, to express an emotion in a similar pattern. And I've always wondered, well, is that a hereditary thing or what is that?
Yeah, well, what a terrific question, because it really helps illuminate how we study character and emotion in the face. So one, clearly, you know, we've learned from, you know, a couple of decades of work on genetics that about half of what we are is genetic, and, you know, due to our lineage and the particular genetic profile we get from our parents. And the other half is environment and so forth. And so part of that story, when you look at a family, you know, you look at the Kennedys or you look at your own family album, part of that story is their particular genetic profile, and it shapes what we call the morphological characteristics of the face, right? Your shape, your chin size, the expanse of your forehead. And then part of that shapes your emotional side to your facial temperament, whether you smile, the kind of your smile, how much your eyes beam, the pucker of your lips when you smile. And that, too, is how we read character into families. And I should tell you, we have a paper that I think will soon be published, in which we actually coded little five-year-olds' family photos with their moms and dads and siblings, and you do see this really striking resemblance in the specifics of their smiles. Mm-hmm. So there is something to it.
What are our? You have a number of questions that you ask in the intro, and they're all fairly profound kinds of questions. What about this question? And you say that we're in a period of probing moral reflection, U.S. children ranking 20th of 21 industrialized countries in terms of social well-being in the past 8 years, which is something. And so you preface all that by asking, how can we be good? If we are good, I would assume that we would feel better.
Yeah. You know, Kathleen, when I regularly teach this new literature on happiness, which is a remarkable science that has been developed by Ed Diener at Illinois and Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Danny Kahneman out at Princeton and others, and Richie Davidson at Madison, and in part cultivated through those panels with the Dalai Lama. And I teach this literature on happiness, and the consensus in this literature, and if your listeners are interested in this, they should read I would definitely read David Myers' The American Paradox, is the United States is underperforming in terms of its well-being. Just to summarize a few trends in the past 20 years, people aren't as happy given the amount of freedom and economic development that we have in this culture, although, of course, that's changed with the economic collapse. More to the point, our kids, and this is a UNICEF study from 2004, ranked 20th out of 21 industrialized cultures. And I think, you know, there's a feeling in the air in our culture right now of where do we go next? What's happening with our culture? What about global warming? the resonance of Barack Obama, if you will, is about who are we as a people. And my conclusion out of that, and I think there are a lot of data that bear this out, is we've tilted away from Gen, from bringing out the good in others and all the emotions that help us with that, toward individualism and materialism. And I hope the book, in part, stimulates a conversation about where we go next.
Yeah. And what about the – you also write a lot about Darwin. And let's look at the science of this. The survival of the kindest may be just as fitting a description of our origins as survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
Survival of the kindest. Isn't that something?
I know. I know. Well, you know, without Darwin, Paul Ekman would not have had the career he had. And you know, your listeners would be it's great to read Darwin in particular. It's 150 years since he published the Origin of Species. His birthday, February 12th, same birthday as Abraham Lincoln, is coming up. And so Darwin first wrote an amazing book about human emotional expression in which he detailed how we express our emotions and how they trace back in mammalian time to the displays of our other primate relatives. And it really was the first evolutionary statement about our most important emotions. But unknown to a lot of people is Darwin, father of 10, really a devoted father, loving dad, loving husband, great community member, very high gen person, if you will. In his Descent of Man from 1871, he observes that, you know, in looking at human nature and thinking about the evolution of who we are, that sympathy and a feeling of fellow camaraderie to our fellow human beings is the strongest of our instincts. And even says the selfish man is a more timid man and really not the kind of the most direct reflection of our evolution. And what we're seeing in evolutionary science is a lot of new insights that really bring this survival of the kindest thesis to fruition. So, you know, one of the most important is Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy, who says, look, what's the defining characteristic of human social organization? And it's that we're caretakers. We have these offspring that are more vulnerable than any offspring on the face of the earth.
Right.
They take 7 to 8, 45 years to reach the age of independence, and we have to take care of them to keep us going, and that really shifted our design.
And I'm always amazed that most people do it pretty well, and it's so, as you know, as a parent, it is all-encompassing. It's amazing what you have to do.
It is, and you know, and that was part of, you know, we're doing a lot of research on touch and compassion and this branch of the nervous system called the vagus nerve that sort of is a bunch of nerves in your chest, and when you feel inspired, or when you look at children playing and you get this expanse that's warm and liquid-like in your chest, that's the vagus nerve. And having children, you know, having my own two daughters, just brought that sharply into focus, as you said.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for our guest. And here's the number, 800-486-8655, the author of Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. If you want to send an email, you can do that as well. And it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now for Professor Dasher Keltner. He is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Greater Good Science Center. That's a great name, isn't it? Co-editor of the Greater Good magazine. We start our calls with Daryl from La Couturier. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning to you and your guest. I had a comment and a question. The comment is, since I'm young, and I'm 60 now, I had a relative that would say often that the eyes are the gateway to the soul. And through life, she showed how that was a truth. And it's helped me in my life, you know, make decisions in relationships based on just what someone does with their eyes. And is there a science of eye reading?
Yeah, Daryl, well, you have a very wise relative, and there is a science, and we've been part of it. let me tell you about a couple of findings. One is one question you can ask as you read the face is how much, when a person smiles, how much are they really happy? How much joy are they really taking in seeing me or in the gift I give them or the joke I tell? And your relative is spot on. The key to understanding a person's love or joy is in the eyes. There's a muscle that surrounds the eye called the orbicularis oculi. And when it contracts, it pouches your cheek and your lower eyelid and then gives you crow's feet. And it turns out that muscle could be called the happiness or love muscle in that when it contracts, people feel happy. That a nine-month-old, when she or he sees the mom approach, that muscle contracts. When a stranger approaches, they just smile, but without that muscle. And Richie Davidson at Madison has shown when that muscle contracts, the part of the brain that is associated with happiness is firing. So that the eyes really tell us how joyful people are. And the second finding that I'll just relay to you is we've done research on love and trust and devotion. And there is this fascinating pattern of people looking into each other's eyes that really is the foundation of love and trust in a lot of studies. And in fact, is associated with oxytocin release in some of our research, which is a little chemical in your body that helps you trust and connect and be devoted.
Hmm. Thank you, Gerald, for your question. Leslie is next from Preston, Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Kathleen. Boy, this is a really cool hour to piggyback on with the last hour. Seriously, this is what I think anybody in the Midwest, we're kind of raised with these values or whatever that appreciate these things that your guest is talking about. But a mother or anybody that nurtures kids just knows the power of what you're talking about. And when I think of what's going on in Gaza and everybody kind of blaming everybody else, they're so out of touch with what will really help. It's not blaming, it's getting back in touch. And I wonder, how can those people who have been warring for 40 years get back in touch with their emotions? And it's like, on a bigger scale, the people on Earth know what your guest is talking about, but the governments are so opposite of that, where they're so materialistic and capitalistic and against everything. So I have a loving family, and I feel so good about my family. But in the background of my life all the time is this government that, and governments that are ruining that basic function for everybody on Earth because they have to be such opposite of what is important.
Hmm. Interesting points.
Yeah, well, Leslie, you're asking, that's a very deep question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the part, you might be think about reading Jared Diamond because he raises a really interesting question as well in Guns, Germs, and Steel, his phenomenal book, mm-hmm. where he says, you know, our basic tendencies in small groups, if you study hunter-gatherer cultures, and there are aggressive cultures and less aggressive cultures, but for the most part, it's toward cooperation and generosity and sharing and equality. And the minute you have the development of resources that become stable resources, you lead to hierarchies, and you have a radical shift in social organization, which you referred to in terms of the dangers of ideology and government. I think your question, we should be asking about our culture at large, which is that when I take a look at the social life of children, and we know our U.S. children aren't faring well, the state of the American family, the state of the American marriage, and community and neighborhood, a lot of these things that are so basic have been taken away from us. Play at school, art at school, and these are things we'll need to reintroduce in our new economy.
Yes, I totally agree. And boy, more power to you. They could use someone like you in bringing the sides together and making people aware of what they're missing out on. I think everybody deep down knows
yeah.
exactly that.
Yeah.
What can we do?
I agree.
Thank you so much for your call, Leslie.
You bet.
Our number is 800-486-8655, and Libby is next from La Crosse. Hi, Libby.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the professor about his thoughts regarding the possibility that we could actually be devolving, really reversing some of the trends, with particularly when it comes to kids and how they develop their brain development and the amount of screen time and the amount of, you know, not human contact, because these are the things you're talking about are things that we can only learn or develop through learning from other human beings.
Wow, Kathleen, you have a provocative audience.
We do. Yes, we do. We have
very thoughtful. Yeah, you know, Libby, I don't want to grandstand, but I agree with you, and I think that what we're learning from the study of human development and the study of mammalian development is that mammals literally need these kind of things that we've been talking about this hour to develop their brains. They need to be touched. They need to laugh. They definitely need to play. The literature in humans says probably the most important factor that leads you on the trajectory that you live is the warm attachment with your family and caretakers around you. And to the extent that new technologies and new social forms take these aspects of our lives away from us, we could be devolving. We could have more hyperactive stress parts of the brain. We could have less frontal lobe development. And I think a new neuroscience will start to point to that.
Yeah, because that's what I say. I work with kids. I'm a pastor, and I think, you know, in the church where we have definitely a high value on the communal interaction of people, and I'm just amazed at sometimes it's almost like a whole other world for folks that haven't been involved in conversations intergenerationally as they're growing up.
And, exactly.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, thanks for your work.
Thanks, Libby. Yeah.
And on that, there's a remarkable finding about really altruistic people who actually helped save the Jews during the Holocaust. And one of the things that they report is intergenerational contact and the centrality of their grandparents in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very good point. So is there a way, if we agree, and I think most of us listening here would agree, that gratitude and compassion are key to living a life that is meaningful, how do you get to them? How do you nurture that in other people, nurture that in yourself, nurture that in your family, and also acknowledge it when you see it in others?
Well, that really is the $64 million question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's fine to say that these things exist and have been shaped by evolution and are built into our nervous systems, and I think that's important in its own right. But we have to ask, and especially in light of where our children are today, which we've talked about, which is how do we cultivate these things? And there is a new science or a scientific wing to the study of human well-being and the meaningful life that is providing remarkable data about how, through simple practices and simple contemplative or reflective approaches to your life, you can cultivate compassion and gratitude. Let me give you two examples.
Sure.
One is someone I've mentioned a lot today, is your very own Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And with Jon Kabat-Zinn, he had software engineers, I think it was, in Wisconsin, practice a mindful meditation where, in particular, they focus on loving kindness toward others, or compassion, this great moral emotion, if you will. Lo and behold, several weeks later, those individuals showed a shift in their brain activation to the left frontal lobes, which is associated with happiness, and stronger immune response to an influenza shot.
Hmm.
So just reflecting on being kind changes their brain chemistry.
Hmm.
A second study that is really emblematic, and it's interesting. I give a lot of talks to healthcare providers and teachers and parents, and this is spreading like wildfire and is very applicable. Mike McCullough and Bob Emmons did a study about 4 or 5 years ago where they had individuals write gratitudes diaries, right? Just sort of write about what you're grateful for. And then they studied their well-being and health several weeks later, and sure enough, just writing down what you appreciate, what you're grateful for, boosts your health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And now I was just at a talk with a bunch of teachers, and teachers are getting kids to write these three things they're grateful for, and they're filling their classrooms with this. So those are direct ways that we can build these emotions into our lives. And I would say the same for other things like touch and laughter and play and modesty, that they're readily cultivated.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that great? And they're not terribly difficult to do.
Not, they don't cost anything. So
right.
This is the free social capital of well-being.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, Libby, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Ann from Delafield next. Hi, Ann.
This is Mary Ann.
Oh, it's Mary. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I just saw Ann. It's Mary Ann. Hi,
yeah.
Mary Ann.
Well, I love the timeliness of this discussion, and I was just at a summit in Madison last week based on the Wisconsin Task Force on Creativity, which was it's a work of a labor of love from a lot of people, but Lieutenant Governor Lawton and...
Sure, we talked with her just a couple days ago.
Oh, you did?
Yes, we did.
I missed the discussion. So it's kind of this whole idea that we are so focused in schools, and I'm an educator, on, you know, developing those wonderful logical, you know, brain patterns and all that kind of stuff with math and science. Awesome. We must do it. Of course we must. But yet at the same time, we find that, and we really do find this is true, we are losing the time and the impetus to develop that other side and that creative side. And we're all becoming quite concerned about it, not just those of us in the arts, but just, I think, educators and parents and our society at large is kind of saying, oh, wait a minute, you know, we're kind of seeing a different attitudes emerge. And when I hear your guest, I love the conversation talking about this, like, this is exactly what we're talking about. Mm. You know, this is that idea. And taking the time and devoting the time to cultivate those practices, and it is, you know, it is reflective practice, it is creative practice, it is a kind of thought-probing kind of practice that we tend to be losing, because I believe the systems that have been in place for the past several years kind of are telling us, no, we got to test different things here, so you can't spend as much time talking about that part of a child's development. So I just like a comment from your guest, and I have one just quick question. What teachers do you speak with, and in what capacity? I mean, are you an in-service coordinator, or are you, like, working with the language folks? Or I'm curious about your capacities in the school.
Well, the answer to that last question really is through the Greater Good Science Center, and we created the center at UC Berkeley, and we have a very dynamic website to provide the context for a conversation with teachers and healthcare providers. And so they know about this latest science. We know what kind of practices they're doing, and to stimulate that collaboration. And I talk to lots of healthcare providers in continuing education courses, and then visit schools and summer camps on a pretty regular basis, as do other members of our center. You know, Marianne's point, again, is part, I believe, of this larger cultural reflection that we are immersed in right now about have we over-prioritized certain things in educational settings, much as we have in our culture at large. And I think one answer, and it's so great that you're leading this way in this conversation about how do we get back to the raw materials of creativity and cultivate that in our children. I always find inspiration in Danny Goleman and his idea of emotional intelligence. And his idea is, mm-hmm. look, reading others and being compassionate and playful and understanding all the multiple levels of that is probably the one switch, if you had one, to turn on with your kids, is to get them to be empathetic and caring and playful and healthy members of communities. And that idea has spread like wildfires through organizations and schools and the like. And what I would add to that is that, lo and behold, those emotions that we've been talking about today, of being compassionate or playful or knowing how to diffuse a conflict through laughter, are actually, the science says, the impetus for intellectual creativity, for mathematical development, for sophisticated writing. So we have to have those in place for the, quote, more logical, rational mind to really flower.
Thanks, Mary Ann, so much for calling. And we'll take more calls in a moment. The author of Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, is with us this hour. It's We're having a good time. Professor Dasher Keltner is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Greater Good Science Center, also coordinator of the Greater Good magazine. And the book combines stories of a lot of things: scientific discovery, personal narrative, and Eastern philosophy. It is a study of how emotion is the key to living the good life, how the path to happiness goes through human emotions that connect people to one another. And it's good. It's good. Let's take more phone calls in a moment. Oh, also the email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls, and Tom is next from Marathon. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Hello.
I'm interested in the habit that some people have of either looking directly into your eyes when they talk or the habit of not doing that. And I noticed that a lot, especially in adolescent boys, where they're kind of a natural embarrassment or shyness, where they will tend, especially with an adult, will tend not to look at you, or always tend to kind of look away, and sometimes that stays on into adulthood. And I wonder if there's anything about eye contact that says something about how we are developing emotionally or not.
Wow, what terrific questions, and they play off Daryl said earlier about relatives saying the eyes are the window to the soul. So I've actually done 5 to 10 years of research on eye contact and emotion. And what we know, and it's fitting with your hypothesis, Tom, is that shy people, and when you're feeling momentary bursts of embarrassment, you tend to avert your gaze and look down. And so that is a very reliable indicator of feeling modest and deferential, or in other words, submissiveness. And your observation about adolescent kids is spot on. And the thinking in the psychological literature is that adolescence is a time when kids become very aware of social hierarchies, who's bigger, who's not, et cetera. And that's when a lot of the social anxieties and shyness really come online, if you will. And so that would be why you see adolescent kids being more deferential with eye contact. The more general point is, and it's an amazing science, is that how we use our eyes is one of the most important tools in gen, if you will, or connecting to others. There are studies showing little infants have very systematic patterns of gaze, where they look at other people's eyes, they look at the mouth to gather information about what's being vocalized. And then people who have certain kinds of social deficits, like early autism, that whole system of eye contact is disrupted, and they look at the shoulder and they look off into space, so they're not gathering so much important information about the person they're with.
Thanks for the call. Could we spend just a moment talking about awe before we go back to phone calls? Because I love that feeling of awe, and you get it doing talk shows every now and then, and when you look at the stars, or you look at, you know, the variety of what's on Earth, all of that. How do we express awe? Do all of us feel awe, and why?
Yeah, I love the feeling of awe, too. And it's funny, when I first started my career in emotion research, I visited Paul Ekman, who was about to hire me as a postdoc. And I was sitting with him, and I said, you know, where should the field of emotion go? And he said, well, we should really study things we've never studied before, like awe. And, of course, I quickly spent 15 years of my life studying embarrassment and humiliation. But I got to awe eventually. And when we started to write about awe, there were only 11 articles in the entire field of social sciences that had mentioned awe.
Huh.
And so on the first stop, so what is awe, right? You go out into the, you know, you hike out into a moraine in Wisconsin, or you hike in the redwoods out here in California, and the experience of awe, I think, is revealed in somebody who started at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is John Muir.
Mm.
And John Muir became awestruck by nature and its designs and its patterns, as did Charles Darwin, and awe was really a seminal part of Darwin's thinking about evolution. And so John Hyde and I, John wrote The Happiness Hypothesis, started to think about, well, what unites our feeling of awe at a political rally, in nature, in art, the more dark side to awe, you know, the Nazi spectacles and the like. And what we've arrived at was two critical pieces. One is that you are encountering something that is new, right, that you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that it's large and vast.
Mm-hmm.
And everything, even if you look at a tide pool, which is small physically, the patterns and the designs kind of transcend your current understanding and seem vast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's our conceptual analysis, and that helps us make sense of when you're inspired by a virtuous person, right? When you are inspired in nature and feel awe. So what is it physically? And there are a few, we're just starting this, and it really is quite amazing. A really interesting question for an emotion researcher. One part of awe is this thing we call the vagus nerve. It is a bundle of nerves that calms your heart rate, gives you this feeling of warmth and connection. It's unique to mammals. And there are some preliminary studies showing when you feel awe in the presence of somebody profoundly inspiring, that part of your body hums.
Oh.
And it makes you want to serve and connect and do good. We have some new neuroscience findings that show that when you see beautiful awe scenery, the left part of your frontal lobes is activated. Richie Davidson has shown that's part of feeling positive emotion and approach and helping. And the most mysterious part is the goosebump. And you talked about it.
Right,
yeah. Talked about it earlier. Now, it's amazing. You know, the goosebump there's a little muscle that surrounds hair follicles in different parts of your body. And when it contracts, it gives you this great sensation of goosebumps, right? And non-human primates have goosebumps when they're in hierarchical arrangements, when they're kind of negotiating power and they're showing how big they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their hair goes up. It's called piloerection. And what I write about is maybe what happens with humans is we change that hierarchical arrangement to a sense of being in a community where we all expand through this sensation of the goosebump.
Let's go next to Joy is next from West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a wonderful conversation. Wonderful subject. I was reminded of a book that I've been reading with a group called The New Earth, and he's talking about awareness and ego. But what I called to talk about was the emotion of pride.
Yeah.
When I have worked, there's, you know, people have this fear kind of pride, like it's something not good, but I'm talking about a pride that works in a good way. I worked in a mental health inpatient unit, and we would have some kind of informal group therapy. It didn't get into heavy things because we had people there for so many different reasons. And, you know, especially one thing that would make the tone on the unit almost scary or hostile was there would be people there who were drug or alcohol dependent, and some of them didn't want to be there and were trying to figure out ways to get cigarettes or drugs or whatever. And then when we would have our group, at the end of the group, I would always ask, what's something, one thing that you're proud of? And I'd go around the group, and sometimes we'd get argument. Once in a while, there'd be somebody who'd say, you know, I'm not supposed to be proud of anything. But once we got over that and everybody got to say something that they were proud of, it was like the whole tone on the unit changed. Mm. You know, they felt better about themselves. They felt better about the staff recognizing something.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I had the people who were staff members also participate. So it felt like we were more equal.
Yep.
And you tell something kind of intimate. So I wonder what you would have to say about that.
Well, you know, Joy's description, and isn't that a wonderful narrative, is really Confucius would be very proud, because that is the kind of therapy for these people who suffer from such difficult problems that we need, which is bringing out the good and the strength of others. And what a wonderful way to do it, which is to ask them about something they're proud about. We know if you just take those clinical populations, like really violent individuals, the most potent or uniform thing we can say about them is they haven't been asked that question enough, and they haven't had that feeling from their parents and their teachers and neighborhoods that they have things to be proud about. And that is the core of that tragedy. Now, pride, the feeling of strength and standing out and a sense of achievement, has some complexities, right? And there is some research that suggests that if you become too proud, as the ancient ways of knowing have long advised us, you can harm the group. You can be too egoistic. You can be too impulsive. You can not practice Zen. And so I think it's like all emotions, we need to cultivate them, but in balance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Susan from Summit next. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, talk a little bit about emotions in my son who has autism.
Yeah.
And, you know, the typical belief is that, you know, that they are incapable of showing emotions.
Yep.
And, you know, they do have eye avoidance occasionally, but I would just like to tell you how I can absolutely tell so easily when he's happy and he's proud of himself and he's delighted, and I only have to look at his eyes.
Yeah.
His, and you want to talk about those muscles underneath his eyes, they just absolutely work right away. You can just see the smile in his eyes and the pride in his eyes.
Yeah.
And it's very apparent. And how much he loves touch and how much he understands the importance when I'm feeling blue that he comes up and gives me a hug.
Oh.
And to give another example, when he was only 5 and in kindergarten, a little girl was crying when her mother left. And she was on the teacher's lap, and he walked over to her, and the bus driver had given him a sticker, and he gave her the sticker. And I thought, boy, does that
amazing.
Show his compassion already, that, quote, he's not supposed to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, I think that's probably a testimony to how engaged you've been, Susan. You know, we so often pathologize people, and there's a debate right now about whether we think about these kinds of, quote, disorders as types of people or really dimensions that we all share, right? And there is such important research that really requires a revision of our thinking about autism and high-functioning autism known as Asperger's that really speaks to your observation, Susan, which is we used to think as a field that autistic kids don't form attachments, and that prevailed for a long time. That turns out to be fundamentally wrong. They form deep attachments. We used to think that they have deficits in all emotions, and that turns out to be fundamentally wrong. And we've actually done research on that showing high-functioning autistic or Asperger's kids, they understand emotions and they feel the emotions much like other kids do. The one thing that we are finding in a few different studies as a field is some of the emotions need a little bit more cultivation, right? Like embarrassment is one. And that points to a couple of really important ways to think about interventions with these kids. One is, and the data are showing, these social skills trainings of making eye contact, using the voice really work. A second that I'd like to just draw your attention to is this vagus nerve that we've talked about earlier, which is about promoting social connection. They're now scientists who are experimenting with vagus nerve stimulation therapies where you stimulate that a little, and it might work with certain kinds of autism. So
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. We only have about a minute left, but I want to talk about humor. Can you cultivate a sense of humor? Your book goes into how important it is, and I'm with you. Can you cultivate that?
Absolutely. You know, and for whatever reason, we don't take play seriously, and we don't take humor seriously, and there are funny studies showing, you know, I forgot what the actual numbers are, but everybody will understand this. Kids laugh 400 times a day.
Yes, right.
The average adult laughs once a week. And all the data are saying laughter is good for marriages and work and, you know, and the individual. And I think there are many ways in which we have to be more playful. We have to, you know, I've done research on teasing and play and calling each other by nicknames and cultivating that that layer of discourse in a family. So, bringing humor back in as a source of art, many ways. So,
yeah. And physically, it does wonders for the body, right?
It does. It does. And some of the new science is saying it's a very deep part of your brain that calms down the stress-related physiology that is bad for your nervous system.
Hmm. What a great hour. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. It was, and I loved our audience. Always love our audience, but they were good today, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, Professor Dacher, Dacher Keltner, Keltner. The book is Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Greater Good Science Center, co-editor of Greater Good magazine. That was fun. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for all the on-air production work here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks for your calls. I'll be with you again Monday, all things political on Monday, as we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday and look forward to the inauguration. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.